Okay, so this is the From Surviving to Living Spotlight Series, and I am here with Al today, and we are going to be talking about a central question or problem, which is not feeling good enough, not measuring up, and not meeting other people's expectations and wanting to be accepted, which is a really common. We all want acceptance in our community. And then what does the God of the Bible say about our identity, our value, our worth? Where does that come from? And so I'm going to turn it over to you a little bit. Al, please tell us who you are and where you're from.
Okay, my name is Al. I'm Al Reff. I'm from originally Duluth. Then I lived in Minneapolis and came here in 1985. So I've been all over the Minneapolis suburbs, and now I'm living in Plymouth, and I've been there for 4 years now.
What made you move down from Duluth to the cities?
My girlfriend at the time got pregnant with my daughter, and so she had come down to take nursing school, and so I followed, get a job, and you know, take care of my responsibility.
Sure. And
just stayed down here, had a career in the school district for a while, and 25 years. So
awesome. Tell us a little bit about then this. I know that you have an interesting background, because we met at Chain Breakers.
Yep.
And so tell us a little bit about what led you to Chain Breakers and what led you to this topic we're talking about.
I had a drug abuse addiction for off and on for several years, and ended up going to prison as a result of it. Committed a pretty serious crime under the influence, and so I had to do 60 to 40. I was spent 40 months in St. Cloud and Faribault. And when I got out, I just basically started my life completely over. Have picked myself up and some good people in my life, and ended up going to Chain Breakers probably within the first few months of being out, staying in a transitional housing, which was near Oak Grove.
Sure.
And so that's how I got connected. Been going off and on. Right. First couple of years, pretty steady, but some decisions. But I go, yeah.
I am going to assume that prison, hitting the moment where you were in prison, wasn't the first time you had ever had trouble in your life. Usually things lead up to that. You mentioned you had a drinking problem.
Found out that I liked alcohol probably, you know, in high school, and certainly by the time I got to college. I was an athlete, so it was limited in high school. Yeah. But once I got to college and was free, then I felt good about everything, and uninhibited, and so smoked a lot of weed, drank, and that was it. And that was, you know, certainly would say I did it in excess at times, but that wasn't it was when cocaine got involved that is when things started going downhill.
And yeah, that's pretty common that people have a party lifestyle in college, and might actually have a problem and not even think of it that way, because it's so accepted that this is just college culture. I'm going to guess that's what your mindset was, and your thoughts were not even
concerned. Was just the thing to do. All of us did it. We go to the clubs on the weekends, and that was the thing. So looking back, of course, I can see the problem areas, and more than the problems, like why I enjoyed doing that. What happened when I would get out of myself and get a buzz, and things became better.
So that was just with the drinking and the weed, as you started to realize that. Can you tell me a little bit about that? What was that? What do you think you were chasing or escaping?
Escaping, just when I felt more confident. I was very confident in superficial things, like I was a phenomenal, I'll just say, basketball player. And the high school I went to, crowds would come to watch and watch me play, and we were very good, and I would get accolades from that. And I loved that part, But when the cheering stopped, I get to college. I did not go to a Division I school. So then it was like, maybe you're not good enough. I was still good in junior college is where I ended up going, but it wasn't the same. And so when I would drink and go to parties, then all of a sudden I could talk to girls, and you know, that became the socialization. That's where I started to get the attention or was able to communicate. And that was pretty much the self-esteem boost, was through partying and going to dances, going to a club and meeting a girl. And so that was kind of the
thing. It kind of made it easier for you to blend in and
feel good
in your community.
Yeah. And even though the people you're interacting with are intoxicated or under the influence, so it's all superficial, but it sure felt good at the time. And you don't think that way. You just think, yeah, we could do that again, you know.
So then it sounds like, just on the surface, that you had a problem and you're solving it quite well. And I'm wondering then, why did you add to it, or how did it lead to cocaine and things?
So I think I'd never had anything like cocaine. The way that made me feel initially was, oh, I can do anything. Like, I am. And it triggered all the senses for me, and it was just great. I've had two bouts. One, when I came down to Minneapolis about 2 or 3 years being here, and tried it, and I went for about 6 or 8 months and was just off the rails with it. And like, why am I spending my rent money? Why am I broke? I know buying weed or a 6-pack or a 12-pack is a lot different than all of a sudden I'm spending $300, $400, $500 in a weekend or a night and not knowing what the heck is going on. But I wanted that feeling again. And so the ups and downs of it. So the first episode was about 1987, 88, and I went into treatment pretty quick and was done. So I was good for the next 20 or so years. The problem was, what initially brought me to that was never addressed, the internal stuff that was going on. I just knew I didn't want to spend all this money and be like that, but I never addressed the internal stuff.
This is a common theme that I have heard from some of my guests, mm-hmm. that they recognize there's an issue, but they're not correctly the real issue. They don't like the symptoms. Mm-hmm. So we need to get rid of these symptoms, and they don't realize there's something deeper happening. So you went to treatment the first time. How long were you in treatment? And tell us just a little bit about what that was like for you.
I thought it was a fix. I went, I think, a couple of times. It was hard. There's some stubbornness to me too. Like, I can control this. I have, and so I think I went and I relapsed just briefly. It wasn't long. Went back in and just decided nothing's going to change. So it was. I felt like I was cured once I got it together and I disconnected with the people. I didn't really have, like, friends that were involved with that. None of my friends really wanted to be any, scared them. So it was easy in terms of just getting away from the where I had to go and what I had to do to obtain it. And so that was easier. And I started to move out further into Fridley and Blaine, and so away from Minneapolis. So I just didn't have the access or any of that, and didn't have to go looking for it. I think the treatment was okay. It got me sober for a while. I don't know if it's so much resistant to that, but I'm very analytical. I'm very, my brain gets in the way of stuff at times, and some of the things that were taught and said, and I took what I needed and left the rest. I think that really prevented the inter. I didn't realize at all that there was something deeper going on. I just knew that's not good for me.
I'm curious then, you had an uncomfortable lifestyle and you wanted to be comfortable again, which means getting rid of spending too much money and using these drugs. However, after you left treatment and became sober, were you still feeling uncomfortable socially or wanting to be more accepted, and now you don't have this helper?
I think I was a little more content because my daughter was born, and so I really focused on raising her and being in her life. And her mother and I just, we had a pretty toxic situation, but we loved our child and we were going to make this work. So got together, stayed together, got married 8 years after, but we were off and on in a relationship, but my daughter was always in my life and we were there. She, one thing I would say, every day she woke up, she was going to see her dad. So that was the focus. And then I got a job in the schools and she was growing up and got involved with her sports and started coaching. And so there was a lot of things that I, as I look back, I didn't really have to deal with myself because of the other things I was looking for that made me feel good were now I'm doing this for my daughter and I'm getting that love. I'm getting that I could do no wrong because I'm dad. And so that was the motivation behind.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like at this time then you had found some purpose.
Yes.
Some meaning, and it was providing respect and affirmation, all of these great things. So then what changed? That was it your daughter getting older, or what made this purpose and meaning not be good enough anymore?
We had a son. So 8 years after my daughter, I have a son. So it's extended the timeline. However, once they got old enough, and it was me and my wife at the time, we're divorced now, but things really became volatile in our relationship because the kids weren't around as much. They were self-sufficient pretty much, and my daughter had gone to college. And so my ex-wife was, she said some things to me that I let get to me, like I was a bump on a lot because I didn't drink, I didn't do any drugs anymore. But she was partying and out her like that. I'm just saying our lifestyles just weren't matching. And so the choice I had was, am I going to be a bump on a log or am I going to go out there and hang out with her? And, you know, so I did. I chose that. And it was so interesting that drinking wasn't really the big deal. But one night we'd gone out to a club and I had probably 4 or 5 drinks and feeling pretty intoxicated. But I went to the bathroom. And when I got in there, there was a guy in there and he said, hey man, you want some of this? And I looked and it was crack. And that does not happen. Like you dudes aren't just hanging out in the bathroom selling them. Well, it's so hard to find. But he said, yeah. I said, let me try it. If it's good, I'll buy everything you got. Sure as heck, I got a little bag from him and I was scared because I had to tell my wife and I didn't do anything until we got home. And then I told her and she was angry and this and that. I said, I didn't care. I was drunk and I took a few hits and it was off to the races. And it was very slow build up, but over time I ended up missing work and got dismissed from basketball because I had a run-in with the police downtown looking for drugs. I didn't have any at the time, but you know, the cops chased me down and beat me up and I had an incident and got charged with fleeing the police, which was a felony, but got down to a misdemeanor. You know, I was still the crack.
And you're still married at this point?
Still married, yes. And that was the beginning of the end of our relationship because I ended up going to treatment because it just spiraled out of control rapidly. I had more money this time around. I had more, you know, so it was every weekend or every other. I ended up going to treatment again. And she wasn't in a position where she wanted or felt the need to stop doing the things she was doing. So while I was in there, it was almost time to complete the treatment. And I found out that she had moved out. That was my problem, this and that. So that was the beginning of the separation.
I'm curious, were you surprised by how easy it was after 20 years of sobriety to be right back into an addiction? Mm-hmm. And this isn't just weed or something else. This is a serious addiction. And so yeah. I would have been surprised. I bet you thought you were cured somewhat.
I don't know that I was surprised. I think I was surprised that the initial episode happened. But once I started, that did not surprise me. I always thought I was the worst. Nobody smokes crack like I do. I mean, I'm just so obsessed with it. It's like, so no, I was not surprised. I just had more access and it became, this is how I'm going to die. That's how it became. It was not necessarily to have fun or to get accolades or meet. It was, I do not like the situation I'm in. I think my wife leaving, and that was a reinforcement of you're not good enough. This is things I've learned since then. But at the time, my family's gone, their kids are grown, they're out of the house, and I'm just sitting here by myself in this house waiting for my family to come back, and nobody's coming back. And so my thing until I just have a heart attack.
And it would be a great way to escape while slowly killing yourself.
Correct.
You're denying the very activity you're doing while it does its work. And so you go to treatment again, and was it a different experience this time?
Treatment wasn't. I think I was doing it to save my job. I was doing it to show some, but I was in, even in there, I'm just fantasizing about it. And I just needed to feel good. I wasn't feeling good when I was sitting in treatment. I wasn't feeling good any other time other than when I was getting high. And for that moment, then I wasn't feeling good. I just wanted to smoke till I didn't wake up or smoke till something happened. I would buy a bottle of booze and slam it and go sit in my garage, turn on the car. Some people found me and brought me to the hospital. I was like, dang, man, I can't.
I'm just curious then, if you're in treatment and you're looking at a sober future, was that scary for you?
I wasn't looking for a sober future. I was doing it because, like I said, the reasons were, if I lose my job, I'm not going to have money to. That's it. I need to.
They had put this in place to keep your job and other things. We need treatment.
Yeah, I went and showed back up to work and stuff. But even I was really good. I was a student advocate, so I dealt with race issues and any kind of multicultural issues with. So I was the go-between, the families, the students, the teachers, administration. I was like the heavy hitter if there were any kind of racial issues or gender issues or anybody treated unfairly. So it was pretty prestigious. I learned a lot. And before the drugs came in, that was another motivation. I was pretty well respected and did a really good job with that.
How old were your kids when you went into treatment? Were they adult age, and did they know?
They knew. My son was, when it started, he was 17, I think, and my daughter was in college. But my son had moved with his mom. And so when I went to treatment, and I felt betrayed because nobody told me this was happening. They came to visit me. Matter of fact, I came home like the Thursday. I was getting out on a Monday. I had a pass or whatever. So we all went out to dinner on Thursday night, and we're talking about looking forward to me getting home, completing this, and blah, blah, blah. And then I find out that they're gone. Like, I called on Saturday and nobody's answering, and I called all day and I got no answers, come to find out. So there was a sense of betrayal. Even if my own son wouldn't answer the phone to tell me this is what's going on.
Yeah.
Then I didn't immediately get out and start using. I was still, I'm going to prove to everybody that this is, but eventually being home in that house alone, waiting for my family, like I said, to come back, work became less and less about the actual job than it was about having a way to sustain my addiction.
A means to an end.
Yeah. Because I'd never missed work, and now I'm missing work, calling in Mondays, Tuesdays, and no sick time. So now I'm losing days. And people, we don't know, but they know. I know I look different. I knew I just, my appearance, I'm sitting in my office, and I'm sleeping half time. I just close my door. And I had very minimal interaction with kids. I didn't want to, I did what I had to do, but.
So what happens after this? How long of a period of time is it from when you leave treatment till you decide that you're just going to forget? It sounds like to me a slow ride into I don't care.
Yeah.
And there must have been another crisis moment for you after.
There's a couple. So I lost my job or retired. I could still get my pension, but I was done with them, which hurt, but I was high at the time, and I just was like, okay, that's one less thing I have to worry about. So ended up going to outpatient. I was stopping for a while. I went, started going back to church, and then I heard about this job in the oil field. So I went out,
just,
yep, I just need to get away from everyone, get away from the situation. In order to maintain my house, I had to work, I had to find something. I went to Dickinson, North Dakota, and commuted. I worked in the oil field during the oil boom. I was making crazy amount of money, but so I was able to maintain my house and get my son graduated from high school, even though he was living with his mom. I did that, but I was away from the situation. No drugs out there. Well, there was, but I initially didn't partake. Came back home a few times. The situation just wasn't good. Eventually, I would come back and right into town and then go right to Minneapolis Street, see if I could get some dope. I had met someone on dating or something, and so we connected, and I really wasn't in a position to love anybody or care sex, and eventually she got her using drugs. So that became the relationship, and then the situation that I got myself into was we decided to quit. That went on for about a year.
Quitting drugs or quitting the relationship?
No, using together. Oh. And it just kept escalating and decided we're going to stop. And I couldn't see her and, you know, or stay there. Every time I'd stay there or she would stay with me, we would result to going to get drugs. That's all the relationship began. And I didn't care. I just, so we stopped for a while. And then I went to her house one night and we ended up getting some more that night, had an incident, her daughter came in, so one thing led to another, and I was arrested, a sexual offense. Yeah. Go to prison for that 40.
You mentioned you had gone to church.
Oh, yeah.
Did you grow up in a family that took you to church?
Yeah, my dad's a pastor. He's retired now.
Yeah, that must have been so hard for him.
Oh, it was hard for everyone, yeah.
Did you keep a lot of secrets then because of who your parents were and what their expectations were?
No. I think my parents are, it's a tough one. They hoped I would take after my dad because they've always seen or felt that I had that despite all this stuff. My dad never expected me to. They hoped I would, but he never expected. He's very much leave it in God's hands with me because Lord knows nobody else can deal with me. So that was tough. And so I was embarrassed for the family. I certainly wasn't trying to, but I was just going through just some terrible things. And of course it always affects those around you.
Did you keep in contact with them through this whole
time? Oh yeah, my dad, they drove me to treatment a couple times. I have an assessment. I didn't have a real good relationship with them. Growing up, they're from the old school, and things to me, discipline-wise or whatever, has to make sense. If it doesn't make sense, then why are, you know? So I was, you would say, rebellious. Not in a, you know, I didn't get in trouble. I was a straight-A student. I was great grades. Like I said, star basketball player, all this stuff. But I didn't understand their harsh discipline. And it wasn't like biblically disciplined. It was just, I come to find out, this is how they grew up in an abusive situation. And, you know, my mom had me when she was 16. So
for them, it was probably normal. Yeah. This is what everyone does. Yeah. And so they're going to continue to.
Correct. Yeah. And for me, I'm like, why are you doing this? I don't do things to get in trouble. Why am I in trouble? And then the other thing being the oldest, I could see their growth and learning as parents on down through the siblings. But I am still the one that had these wounds from.
Yeah, you were how they learned to raise the other ones.
What I want to do or do we not want to do it this way? Yeah. But yeah, this is all we know. Yeah. So that was come to understand. That's where it all started. That's where it manifested. And not being allowed to express feelings or thoughts or because I said so is
a rejection of your authentic self.
Correct.
Which is really a challenge if you are trying very hard to do your best and you want that to be seen. And the response you're getting is something else entirely.
Yeah.
Then I better stop doing this authentic thing I'm doing and adjust. And I'm wondering if, and I'm sure this is true, it's almost impossible for someone who upset with someone, they're never going to be satisfied. There's nothing you can do to be perfect in their eyes. That's their demeanor, unapproval.
And just, yeah, it's what is wrong with me? you don't like me. You may say you love me, but your attitudes towards me very strongly suggest to me, I'm perceptive, I can get it, you don't like me. Okay? Yeah. You like what I do because I'm a straight A student and I get good grades and you can show me off because I hear you on the phone telling all your girlfriends how proud, Alphonse came home with straight A school. Meanwhile, you didn't tell them that, sit your butt in here, we're going to conferences and you better not have a bad, you know. So you're terrified to go to conference when they're, because back then it was a half day. So you're sitting in the home just thinking about the whole 9 weeks. Did I do one thing wrong that they're going to tell? Well, you're just in terror. And then you come home, or they come home from conference, and here's your report cards and straight A's, no discipline. But there's no pat on the back. Mm-hmm. There's no good job. There's no I'm proud of you. That's the expectation.
Sure.
And that's it. But then you come downstairs and you hear her on the phone bragging to all her friends. Say that to me.
Yeah. So then prison seems a really unlikely place to have some of these things that you're searching for. Did you find some direction in prison, or did that come later?
No, that's where it came. That prison was the life-changing event. Not only, because I've always been a believer, I accepted the Lord when I was like 7 years old, but I heard Charles Stanley, I think, once say that oftentimes men have a perception of God due to their father. If I'm terrified of my dad and know I can't do anything right in his eyes, that's how God sees me. He only sees the bad stuff and the wrath of the Lord. And yeah, Jesus loves me, but God is going to get you, man, because look what you did. You kissed that girl, or, you know, we're thinking about this, or you did a... And it's just this constant, like, I'm not good enough. I'm not, you know, that's my... So why would I get up in the pulpit and follow my dad's? Because God doesn't like me. Mm-hmm. Nobody likes me unless I make them by being on drugs or being drunk or be superficial, you know, the authentic self. Nah.
I have a very similar story to yours in that being a believer and raised in a church-oriented family, but... This has been a common theme I've heard, where there's a difference between the moment of salvation and really making God Lord of your life. Mm-hmm. And so it sounds like what about to have happen here is an understanding he needs to be the boss of you.
I don't know that I look at it as him being a boss of me. I think that's, for me, that would be, you know, I don't like bosses. I'm not someone that gives in to titles and authority very much. I'm very much people are equal, and I understand your position, even at work. I understand your title as manager, but it doesn't give you a way to treat me, talk to me, like, down to me. No, we're not doing that. But that's just me. That's part of my, and I accept that now. What happened is so the ironic part was, as working with students for my whole career and just elevating them and being part of their lives and coaching girls and coaching boys and just trying to get them to be the best versions of themselves that they could be, and then have a situation where me and this woman and her daughter have some inappropriate acting. That hurt me. Like, I know that hurt them and her, but for me, it was against all values that I have, and having a daughter myself. So that was the struggle for me. And then when I went into prison, aside from having to not be a target, soft person, and adopting this attitude of, you're not going to be doing stuff to me. Like, I'm not that guy. So if I have to die, then we'll just go. And I'm not a tough guy. But in there, you have to present. You have to. And there's some things that I've seen that it's like, this is a different world. It's different rules. It's different. I don't get it. I don't want to get it. But I don't want any of that stuff happening to me. So I adopted a very hard exterior. Meanwhile, what's going on inside was my relationship with the Lord, because everybody else was gone. Like, it's just me and him now. And what's going to happen? What are we going to do with this? So I started to, I ended up going through Quest for Authentic Manhood program and addressing some of the wounds that we have. And it's a biblical, scriptural-based program, Christian-based program. So we started with my dad, and I was able to, some light bulbs just started to come on about how do you see your father, how do you do, what would you tell him? And it was very emotional, and I just want my dad to love me, because I would sit next to him and listen to his sermons. I got the little record player with all preachers, and I would just sit there listening to him with them, and I love listening to my dad preach. I get it, you know, it moves me. The word forgiveness, learning that forgiveness is so we're not holding on to these resentments. And so the Lord was working on me with all of these things, and I became a mentor in there. I went through some treatment in there, but it was more, I was really in tune with the spirituality and God. However, I always had the guilt blanket. It's, I'm going to chapel, I'm reading my Bible, I'm understanding where I get it, I do this. And yeah, but I did this thing that says if you harm one of these, yeah, Jesus is forgiving and he died and all of that was, but I never got rid of the weight of what had happened for about 2 years. First, I was learning about what's going on internally, but spiritually, I still had the God is gonna, it was just there. He's gonna avenge this. And, but yeah, I was going to chapel. I was saying things in chapel. I was leading Bible studies. And internally, I still had this thing going on. The miraculous moment came. I was in chapel, and they had, the chaplain said that they have this program that they were doing. They were going to be starting. It's called Pastors to Prisoners. So if you want a pastor to connect with you, sign up. You know, send us a note, and we'll see if we can match you up with somebody. They'll just come in and visit and pray with you. And talk. I'm like, at this point, that prison thing had built up, so I didn't trust people. I was leery. I'm not gonna be touchy feely, all this stuff. But I do think I need to pray with somebody on a regular basis. So I got a message that this pastor wanted to meet with me, and his name is Pastor Dave and David Mackey. And he came in, and you know, I said, so tell me your story. What's going on? And he was this bubbly guy, but I didn't trust him right away. He was just like, okay, I'm just going to do this. And so I think it was the second time he came, I told him the story and what's been going on. And he said the magic words to me. And he said, he appreciated me sharing my story. He said, but Alphonse, he said, what do you know about grace? And it just hit me like this amazing grace. And he says, no, let's explore God's grace. The next several months, he would come once a month, and we would talk about grace, and every time I would just get a better understanding. And then it hit me that God has spoken through these prison walls that you don't have to carry this. You are forgiven. You've worked on forgiving everybody else, and I want you to know that I have forgiven you, demonstrated this, and I've demonstrated my grace by sending my son, meaning all of the sins, all of them, were nailed to that cross. And you do not have to walk around with this anymore. Mm-hmm. And that was so incredible. It was life-changing. And Pastor Dave came, and he continued to, we just talked. And he was just a regular guy. When we said he wanted to meet my family, and he did, he would come, and he said, so I met your sister, I met your daughter, I had tea with your daughter and your parents. And he's, yeah, your dad's a little reserved, I think he was suspicious. I was like, yeah, this is my dad, and he's not gonna say too much. But so then we had a relationship after I got out, and man, he was there, and we would go to ball games, and we used fishing, and we'd listen to sermons. And he was a Lutheran pastor, so I went to his church, and he, you know, and then I said, here, man, we gotta listen to one of my sermons. And so we're in the fish house listening to sermons, but we would talk about the Lord, and we constantly talked about grace and relationship. He said, it's just about relationships.
I love that you said that, because that's absolutely true. We hear a lot about personal relationship with Jesus, mm-hmm. which is an important relationship that one can have and experience, but there's more. God created us as relational beings,
correct.
And so it's about relationship with each other.
And what it did and what I've been empowered to look back over my life and recognize this is why you did what you did. You were not feeling accepted. You were feeling rejected. But God accepts you. And that has come into the core of my being. And I don't worry anymore. And I know it's tough because get grace. I just understand. It's my motto for life now. And I have a sign in my home about grace. And that's what they call me the grace guy at Chainbreakers. Because I don't get caught up in the things I had done or the things I'm going to do or this. I said, God has taken care of all of that. My deal now is, listen, that grace doesn't mean you get to do anything you want. I said, no. Why would you want to? Somebody loves you now and you just want to make them happy.
Yes.
So you're going to try to do things that pleasing that other person. I said, love is when you have it on the inside, it comes out and you start to do things that way. But I don't get tripped up if I make a mistake. Somebody cut me off and I called them one day. And my girlfriend was like, hey, I've never heard you talk like that. I'm not going to get all bent out of shape for that. I'll take that to the throne of grace. And Lord, I need to work on this. I know that some prison residue is still there.
As you're talking, a verse in the Bible that I mentioned quite often on my blog, because I thought about it a lot after I started reading the Bible in prison. Mm-hmm. And the verses are in Romans 7 and the beginning of Romans chapter 8. And so in Romans 7:15, it says, "For I do not understand my own actions. I am baffled, bewildered. I do not practice or accomplish but what I wish, but I do the very thing that I loathe." Mm-hmm. And he goes on towards the end of the chapter to say, "Oh, unhappy and pitiable and wretched man that I am, who will release and deliver me from this body of death?" And what you said is the best part after, "Oh, thank God, he will, through Jesus Christ, our Lord." And he goes just on to say, like you talked about, that this is through Christ Jesus' sacrifice and the Holy Spirit working in our lives. Mm-hmm. Humbling to know that the Apostle Paul, who wrote so much of the New Testament, could say these very things about himself, and we know that he was a terrorist mm-hmm. himself, and so carried a lot of guilt. And he saw this as the solution. If it's a solution for him, it's good for everybody.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We are getting close to our time, okay. But I want to ask you one more question. Mm-hmm. Looking back on all that you've just shared and even more that you know, if anybody were in the situation you had been in, what advice would you give them? What advice could you, your old self, if mm-hmm. you could go back in time?
The thing I try to talk to people now about is identifying what it is that is causing you or making you feel self-destructive. And that self-destruction manifests itself in a lot of ways. I say, allow God to reveal what's trauma, maybe, what issues from youth, where it usually comes from, is causing us to build these defense mechanisms and these protective things, but also medicate. I don't want to feel this. I don't know why I'm doing this. I would encourage people to really try to dig in and not be afraid of that, because that's where the truth is, and that's where the healing is, and that's where God can come in, allow him, and take that over. And then the other thing is really focus on grace. And when you hear those words, amazing grace, what does that really mean? That saved a wretch like me. It means you're saved, and to believe it. And it's not our own strength. I can't be good enough to undo all the bad stuff. Only Jesus can do that. So I don't have to have that burden. I don't have to walk in this perfection. I'm perfected through Christ. And as long as I'm connected to the vine, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And that's my message. Is it's so humbling, but yet it's so empowering at the same time.
It is. And I like what you said of connected to the vine. Jesus says in John 15:3, without me, you can do nothing.
Correct.
But Paul also says, with Christ inside me, I can do all things.
Correct.
And that's so powerful for someone that's really struggling. It's not just the grace of forgiveness, but a hopeful future filled with purpose and with meaning that is possible.
Yes, yes.
And that's what sounds like you're describing. So I want to thank you for
thank
coming
you
here.
Thank you for having me. This is amazing.
Yes, yes. Thank you so much for sharing your story. And, you know, I am interested in knowing what happens in your future, where mm-hmm. you go from here. A lot of this is recent. And I believe that when God puts us through difficult, hard things, it's because there are even greater things he wants to use for. And I'm certain that's going to be true with you. And so I want to hear about it.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And for more great episodes like this one, I want you to visit me at hollybot.me and check out all the From Surviving to Living Spotlight episodes. Thanks for joining us.
Look for more episodes that inspire at hollybot.me. Until next time, remember, your story is never over. God's grace is always waiting to rewrite it. This is From Surviving to Living.